I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Max Barenbrug, the co-founder of Bugaboo. Bugaboo designs and manufactures the multifunctional strollers that can be spotted on the streets of New York, Chicago, D.C., and Los Angeles. The Bugaboo strollers are known for their versatility and their focus on the parents. Bugaboo is an infant-to-toddler traveler system that transforms from a bassinet to a toddler seat and can also accommodate an infant car seat. Bugaboo started selling its strollers in Holland in 1999 before coming to the United States in 2003. Bugaboo has almost 400 employees, and the strollers are now sold worldwide in the United States, Canada, the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. Welcome. So you are a Dutch designer born and raised in Holland. Where does your interest in design come from?
I had that my whole life already. I built things for people who are restructured houses. I earned my money in my spare time as a student, building beds, building kitchens, building everything. I made cars for myself. I was mechanical with bicycles, with scooters. And I was very handy, and always the things I made looked nice and were an interesting concept. And I did not know that there was a specific school for that.
You mentioned that you made carts and bikes for yourself.
Yes.
Was there an emphasis on mobility?
Always, yeah. The mobility came first. But there always had to be an interesting element to it. So, for instance, I connected bikes and made a tandem of 25 meters long, things like that. So it had to outstand somehow. People on the street had to say, wow.
Did you ever have 25 people sit on those bikes and ride them?
No, I think I came to 12 or something.
That's remarkable. So you learned that there was actually a school for design for the things that you loved, and you went to the Design Academy in Eindhoven.
Yes.
And you were asked to design a final project. What was that final project?
It were two projects. I graduated in two directions. The one was mobility and the other was leisure. For mobility, I did the stroller, and for leisure, I did the bike, the city bike.
Why did you decide to design a stroller, of all things?
So I was thinking ahead, what products can really be changed? What market is backwarded? What products can be improved? And I found out that strollers were actually quite lousy at that time. And a stroller is an interesting thing because you put your child in it. It has the combination of fabric and metal, the technique, plastic, engineering, and more the fashion thing. And I realized that it had to be that.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 28.
Did you have children of your own?
No.
Were you single?
Yes.
And what did that first stroller look like?
The first stroller was the specialty of the product was that you could jog with it. You could pull it behind you. You could change it from a four-wheeler into a two-wheeler, pull it behind you so you could go on the beach, you could go into the mountains, and you could take the seat off. And the seat was an independent thing. You could put the seat independently on the ground. You could put it on your back and use it as a backpack with your child in it. The functionalities were totally new. And most important, it was designed for men because I did not have children, but I did realize that if I had one, and I would surely wanted children, if I had children, I wanted to have a stroller where I would like to walk behind.
And why did you feel that the strollers that did exist were not designed for men? What was missing in those strollers?
Everything. I think that the products were, the companies that made those products were too much focused on cost price reduction. They were focused on bringing it to as cheap as possible to the consumer. They did not focus on functionality. I think that the target group were women. I have that clear image of men standing outside the baby shop smoking, and their wives were inside the shop, you know, and they had to pass all the pink and all the clouds and all the padding to the stroller, and there the stroller was loaded with teddy bears, and that was a world that was not appealing for men.
It's interesting because in your marketing materials, it is very clear that you are marketing to men as well as to women. They look like a car manual. Mm-hmm. There's a focus on the wheel and the bolts and the infrastructure of the stroller so that when the guy looks at it, he's like, wow, this is cool. Look at these gadgets.
Yeah. Well, they're not gadgets to me. For us, it's very serious. We pay a lot of attention to all the details of the product, but yes, in the end, the consumer, and specifically men, they like our products because it works. And in general, I would say that men have the tendency to say if a product does not work, that the product is not good, and they put the product aside. Women have the tendency to say if the product doesn't work, that it's their fault. So apparently, because all those products were focused so much on women in the early days, there was no necessity to improve it.
Why do you think when women, when it doesn't work for women, they say, oh, it must be my fault, versus when it doesn't work for a man, they say, oh, there's something wrong with the product? Why do you think that is?
Because men are more interested in material, in products. They're more interested. They have something with products, and they want to identify themselves with a product. It's an extension of their hands, of their arms, of their eyes. And I think if it doesn't work, then the product doesn't work, then the product has to be put aside. So my focus is to make the product as good as possible.
And how about for the woman? Why does she say, oh, it must be my fault if it doesn't work?
Maybe she doesn't say it's my fault, but she will not have this thing with the product. She will not say, let's put this product aside. She will live with that product. And apparently, for many, many years, these products were crappy. And apparently, people accepted it.
So you had this innovative design with the seats being able to pop out and the reversible handle and the four wheels go to two wheels. It's like Transformers. How did manufacturers receive the product when you decided you wanted to start a business?
They were not interested in the concept. They didn't understand it, actually. They did not see the potential of the four-wheel, two-wheel position, the whole structure, the whole new revolutionary new structure of the product. Above all, they didn't see that men could be a target group. So they were not interested. As we started our own business, as we decided to do it ourselves, that's me and Edward, my brother-in-law, my companion, they gradually found out that we actually filled a huge hole or gap in the market.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Max Barenbrug, co-founder of the Bugaboo Stroller. Bugaboo is a mobility company that focuses on versatile design, and Bugaboo's four wheels become two, making it easier to walk on sand or snow. With prices close to $1,000, Bugaboo is considered the Rolls-Royce of strollers. So in the years between your final project and actually coming up with a stroller that you can sell, did you earn an income?
No. I did not. So that is, you know, eating straw only. And it was a very difficult period because you have this huge success of the graduation. I won the best prize, got this prize for best graduate of the Design Academy. I got all that publicity by newspapers. I was graduated in both directions with honor. So the success was great. And then you think it will happen, but nothing happens. And you have the feeling that this baby is slipping out of your hands. You want to bring it to a higher level, and you have the feeling that it won't happen. And then there's an investor first, not Edward, my current companion, but there was an investor that stimulated me to continue. But I had to have a lot of patience, and I depended on my brother-in-law. I depended on this investor. I depended on the government enabling me to do it, because of course you get in Holland, you have this beneficiary system. You get money from the state.
So you collected unemployment.
Yeah.
Did you almost give up ever?
Yes. Yeah. I started looking around for jobs. And there were a few design agencies that were interested in my work, where I could get a job. But I never did it. I got advice from a very big design agency in Holland. I went there and asked them, what do you think of this design as it is right now? Do you think it's worthwhile continuing it? Or shall I get this job you're offering me? And they said, if I were you, I would continue with the stroller. So they encouraged me, and that made it all happen.
How about discouragement? Where did the discouragement come from?
Lack of perspective. Yeah. I mean, the passion dies. And that when that happens, it's terrible. Actually, as a designer, I think all designers know exactly what I'm talking about. When there's no inspiration, when there is no passion, then it slips out of your hand. From the graduation project to the Bugaboo Classic, there were many changes to the design. And you can ask yourself, are these concessions or are these improvements? Mm. And for Bugaboo, for me, it is a challenge to make sure that they are improvements. Mm. When I do a concession, I make sure that there are other functionality added to it to make it an improvement again.
How long did it take you to redesign the product and manufacture it and get it out to the market?
It went through several phases. First of all, there was my graduation project. Then we found out that this product was too revolutionary, too much focused on backpackers, too much focused on the outdoor shops. And this product had to be redesigned to be sold in baby shops. So we changed the concept. The first prototype came 2 years later. 1997, this first production model was such a huge success at the Cologne Fair that we realized that we had to redesign again to make the model fit the international standards to enable it the product to be sold internationally. So another 2 years followed, and then the Classic appeared.
Finally.
Finally, yes.
Was there any issues with self-confidence during this time?
No.
In terms of not earning and living and feeling like, goodness, how am I ever going to start a family or anything?
No, not really. No.
Your partner, your brother-in-law, he was the financer of this.
Yes.
What was he doing that he could afford to finance this?
He is a medical doctor, yes. He had this company that educates companies for giving first aid when something bad happens.
And how much did you invest in the company before you started selling the strollers?
At the time, it was about 400,000 guilders. That is about $200,000.
Did you ever have any issues with Edward? I mean, it's sometimes challenging to work with a family member. How was that relationship?
Good and bad, both.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a sales director and when you're a design director, It lies in the function that you will have conflict.
Was there ever time or was there ever one fight that got so heated that you just thought, that's it, I can't be your partner anymore?
In my thoughts, many times. But in practice, no.
I'm Jessica Harris and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Max Barenbrug, co-founder of Bugaboo. We'll hear more from Max coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Max Barenbrug, the co-founder of Bugaboo. Bugaboo designs and manufactures the multifunctional strollers that can be spotted on the streets of New York, Chicago, D.C., and Los Angeles. The Bugaboo strollers are known for their versatility and their focus on the parents. Bugaboo is an infant-to-toddler traveler system that transforms from a bassinet to a toddler seat and can also accommodate an infant car seat. Bugaboo started selling its strollers in Holland in 1999 before coming to the United States in 2003. Bugaboo has almost 400 employees, and the strollers are now sold worldwide in the United States, Canada, the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. When you launched into Holland, you actually had a challenging beginning because you had to recall some of your product. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
We had distributed about 1,000 strollers in the market, and they broke. Something bad happened with the plastic. The production facilities in Taiwan, apparently there was a big difference between the first injected parts and the mass-produced injected parts. And they made a mistake, and the plastic was not strong enough, and the product would break without endangering the child, by the way. Very important. We found out that the first models that broke, we realized we had to do a recall. And because there were only about 1,000 in the market, we could get them back. What we did was Edward had a friend, and they had a huge building where we could change the products, give it new parts. And the father of this friend, he organized students, rent trucks or small buses and drove through the whole country to get all the strollers back into this place, rebuild it, and bring it back again.
What was the customer response when you showed such care in the recall?
It was more the shop that was very impressed by it. The retail was very impressed by it. They thought we were dead, actually. But then there we were again 2 weeks later with new products.
I always say that 10% of life is what happens to you, and 90% of success in life is how you respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that you responded very well. Was that a catalyst for creating your own manufacturing facility since you saw in Taiwan this wasn't working out?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Did you at least try to make it work with a Taiwanese manufacturer?
Oh, yes. I spent many, many months. I think in 3 years' time I was there more than 1.5 years. And it was exhausting. It was very difficult because there was this language barrier. But above all, there is this difference in culture, whereas Chinese have the tendency to cut down quality, to cut down prices, whereas Bugaboo has this clear focus on quality and the cost price of the product is not important. In the end, yes, the consumer price is high, but it's because we pay a lot of attention to the quality of the product.
Your price is around $1,000 for some of the strollers, which is kind of like the Rolls Royce of strollers to some extent. What did the customers think about that when you first presented it to Holland customers?
In Holland, our product is not that expensive. For America, it is, yes. But in Holland, it's not. Our competitors are similarly priced.
We talk about making the analogy to a Rolls Royce and to cars. Do you have any crash test dummies for your stroller?
Yes, we have. But we don't really do crash tests. That's then done in professional laboratories.
What kind of safety testing do you do for your strollers?
We walk with them ourselves, run with them ourselves, take all the obstacles we can find ourselves. What we do is do unusual things like hanging 45 kilograms on the seat and see how it bends and if it breaks. What we do is...
That's a fat kid.
That's a very fat kid, definitely, yes. We put it in the jogging position and then we jog very hard. In the beginning, when we could not afford to send the stroller frequently to the testing laboratories, we tested ourselves in Taiwan, put the stroller in the sea, make sure that there was sand everywhere, see if the mechanical parts still were operating, things like that. That's what we did.
You'd put the stroller in the sea?
Yeah, salt. It attracts the sand and the product gets very sticky and all the mechanisms will get stuck and then you can see if it will work or not.
By the way, where did you come up with the name Bugaboo?
I found it in the dictionary. I was looking for the word buggy and then underneath was written Bugaboo. And I said, hey, that's a nice name. Interesting.
What does it mean?
It means annoying ghost. Teasing little ghost.
Well, some kids, when they're misbehaving, I think, are annoying little ghosts, perhaps.
Yeah, and perhaps we are annoying little ghosts for our competitors as well.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Max Barenbrug, co-founder of the Bugaboo Stroller. Bugaboo is a mobility company that focuses on versatile design and making life easier for the parent. It's interesting that you do focus on the parent, on the user, rather than on the child.
Mm-hmm. I think that when you look at the strollers in history, there has never been a focus on the baby. For sure in Holland, but I also think in other countries, the stroller is a status symbol. When your baby is born, you want the best for your first child. So you buy a stroller, and in the old days, you got the stroller from your parents, or you bought the brand your parents had, or where you yourself were lying in as a baby. And we changed that completely. I wouldn't like a consumer to buy a Bugaboo because their parents like the brand. You want a Bugaboo because you want it, because it fits your lifestyle, because it's the way you want to move from A to B. That's what we are focused on. And that's the parent, that's not the child. Of course, the economic fit for the child is very important, but it's not the biggest issue, really. As a designer, I can tell you that does not take too much time to be focused on. The ergonomics for the parent is much more complex. The way it runs, the way it falls, the suspension is much more complex.
You also have one handle rather than two handles.
Yes.
How does that change things?
I have never understand why why strollers have two handles, because you want to walk with one hand. In the other hand, you hold your drink or your mobile phone, and maybe 10 years ago it was the cigar you were holding in your other hand, I don't know. It gives the product a huge stability. You can steer very directly. It looks much better. It looks less fragile. It's surely a point where we differentiate with competitors.
Speaking of competitors, have there been competitors in the market who are trying now to copy Bugaboo, and how do you respond to that?
When the copy is very close to Bugaboo, we call our lawyer and ask to act against it. But most of the time we do nothing because the copy is terrible.
Hmm. I want to talk about now the entrance into the United States market. Mm-hmm. You were so popular in Holland. What was the motivation for turning to the United States next? How often had you come to the United States before?
Never. No, never. But I'm not a big traveler. I like to go home. Tonight I'm home again.
So then who did it for you?
In Holland, we met Carrie Boiler. And she planned to go back to L.A. with her husband and her daughter, Charlie. And she was interested in the Bugaboo. She had one. And she had friends in America that were interested in the product. She helped us starting up in America. And I think also via her, there was this pure accidentally connection with Sex and the City, and that all came together.
Your debut was on Sex and the City in 2002. Have you watched much of Sex and the City?
My wife did, yes. I didn't.
Well, it was the phenomenon in the early
2000s. Yes, I know.
What happened after showing up on Sex and the City?
I don't know if it was our big break, really. I think that the press took it up. The product itself did it. The funny thing is, in Holland, when we started in Holland, we didn't do marketing at all. You should have seen our first brochures. They were terrible. We didn't want to spend money on it because it was expensive, and we thought we don't need it. We had not a real idea about it. The selling started straight away without marketing. Sex and the City accidentally happened, and of course we were very happy and proud that it happened, but I don't think it really, really helped. The American market was totally ready for a product like a Bugaboo product. A product that was focused on quality, on user-friendliness, on totally different from other strollers.
That's your opinion, but when products are used by celebrities, especially those on, you know, Sex and the City, consumers go wild because they love copying celebrities,
yes,
to some extent.
Yes, that is true. But then I say again, it was in the movie maybe for 2 seconds. So the success was that the press started talking about it. Mm-hmm. So it became visual. It was not visual when it was in Sex and the City. It became visual when people started talking about it.
And you've had quite a few celebrities buying your stroller. Which celebrity kind of tickles you the most, the fact that they've been interested?
Madonna. Absolutely. And our Princess Maxima. And they both bought it. Fantastic.
And how much do you think celebrities have impacted the sale of the stroller in Holland, for example, or worldwide?
In Holland, I don't think that much because we are quite no-nonsense people. But I think in America, it did play a role. Definitely, yes.
When you say that the United States, that consumers adopted the product and they were ready for it, were they as accepting of the price as customers in Holland?
No, they had difficulty with it. But, the product is worth it. So what can I say?
What are some of the differences culturally between Dutch and American consumers in your opinion?
Somehow the American market was settled in a way which was dictated by the offering of the manufacturers at that time, which was people buy 5 strollers, they buy a big one, they buy an umbrella, they buy something for in the car of mommy, they buy something for in the car of daddy. And so the products had to be cheap and simple, but the complexity lied in the fact that they had 5 strollers.
Mm.
So our complexity is that we put it all in one product. That is the difference. Mm-hmm. The difference is that in Holland, products have always been more complicated than in the United States.
How about customer service expectations? Are customers more demanding in one place or the other?
The consumers in the United States are more demanding, yes, but because we take care of it so well and because the product is operating well, we don't have big problems with demanding customers.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Max Barenbrug, co-founder of the Bugaboo Stroller. Bugaboo strollers first hit the streets of Holland in 1999 before making their high-profile debut in the United States on the TV episode Sex and the City in 2002. What is your position now? What is your role?
To inspire the design team.
And you're not the CEO. Did
No.
you ever have any desire to
No,
be the CEO?
No, absolutely not. No. And Edward hadn't either. You have your passion. My passion lies within design. Edward's passion lies in networking, retail. The quality is know your strength. So the things I'm not good at, I outsource. For instance, marketing in Bugaboo is outsourced. Edward is doing the sales. We immediately hired a good operational director. So know your weaknesses and know your strength. Mm-hmm. That is very important. And don't have a big ego wanting to do everything yourself.
How about your personality? I think it was Nietzsche who says that the chaotic mind gives birth to a star. Where do you fall into that in terms of where does your innovation come from? Where does your inspiration come from?
In my company, I behave strange. I can behave strange. Maybe I have some of the features, yes. But I would say that when it comes to design, I'm extremely serious. And it's just hard work. It's really being very critical, being very persuasive. It requires total dedication by the designers and by myself to come up with the best. Mm. And if it's not good, they have to do it all over again. And because that's what I went through. And that's the only way it works. It's hard work. You have to go to bed with it in your head. And you wake up with it in your head. Mm. And you cannot let go. Mm. And what your thrills are the small successes in the process. That is where you have to get your satisfaction from. And for the rest, it's really tough. Really, really tough.
How about your personal life at the time? Did you meet your wife while you were developing Bugaboo, or was this after it had finally gone
no,
to market?
No, before. I met my wife in 1997. We only had a prototype. She actually went through the whole success from being very, well, poor to successful.
And was she supportive the whole way?
She supported the whole way, yes. Mentally, you mean?
Yeah, I mean mentally, when you're going to bed at night and you've had a tough day, is she supportive?
Oh, yes. In my relationship with her, she supported me. But she did not business-wise supported me. Mm-hmm. So I could find the rest at home. I could find the peace at home. I didn't find the solutions at home.
Do you have children now?
Yes.
How many?
Two daughters.
Do I have to ask if you use the Bugaboo?
Yes, of course. No, not anymore because they're 4 and 6 years old. But my oldest child, when she was 1 year old, she was this test dummy for me. I found out with the Classic that the suspension was too rough. So I came up with the frog-like suspension, a huge improvement on the design.
You mentioned the frog, a later model of the Bugaboo.
Exactly. And this fork-like suspension was revolutionary and still is in our product. All our products have this suspension. Actually, the fork suspension jumps over the obstacle. That's why we call it the fork-like suspension.
Interesting. You've had several models on the market. You started off with the Bugaboo Classic.
Mm-hmm.
What are the names of these models?
We came with the Bugaboo, the first one. Now we call it the Classic. Then we came with the Frog. We had to differentiate from the Classic, so we named it the Frog. That was the moment where we introduced the names of animals. Then we came with the Gecko and the Chameleon. The Chameleon and the Gecko and the Frog and the Classic, they're all modular products. They consist of two elements, the undercarriage and the seat. The seat can be used independently on the ground, can be carried. You can take the carry cot off or the bassinet off, take it into your house. The B is an all-in-one compact stroller. It is actually more what Americans are used to use. You can fold it in one action. You can unfold it in one simple action. You don't have to do complex things. It has all the qualities the Frog has as well, like the frog-like suspension, the integrated design, the beautiful design, the reversible seat, the big canopy. But it's a one-piece stroller, and it is not the fully loaded stroller. It's the stroller that you use for going into your car, getting out of your car, going to the shopping mall, getting home again, quick, quick, quick. That is the B.
In design, there's always that argument between form and function, where you want the product to look beautiful, but you also want it to work beautifully.
Yes.
How do you reconcile that?
What Bugaboo really tries to do is to come with integrated design. You have this form follows function thing, what people think Bugaboo is. People say Bugaboo is form follows function. But in fact, what we try to do is to in the design process, make sure that all functionality has a beautiful outlook. If it cannot be made beautiful, we skip the functionality and come up with something else. So if you go to the basic of the design, if you go to the core of the product, and if you make that as simple as possible, no matter how complex it is, you in the end you come up with the essence of the product.
You have a real interest in mobility. Where do you see Bugaboo going?
Bugaboo is a mobility brand. We don't design strollers only. It could be rollators. That's for the elderly to make sure that they don't fall. It's this carriage around them that prevents them from falling, supporting them. Rollators, luggage transport systems, it could be bikes, it could be scooters, it could be anything.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Max Barenbrug, co-founder of Bugaboo. Coming up, we'll meet Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi, a leading luggage and travel accessories company. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi, a leading travel accessories company. Tumi has been making high-end, durable travel bags since 1975, and the company has over 50 retail stores worldwide, with locations in Tokyo, London, New York, Paris, and Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be with you this afternoon.
Where does the name Tumi come from?
I was actually in the Peace Corps with my wife from 1967 through 69, and we lived in Peru, worked in Peru, and the Tumi was a god figure, an icon-like symbol of the department, which is the equivalent of a state where we were living at the time. We named a dog in Peru Tumi, and we came back from Peru and named another dog Tumi, and when we were setting up the company in 1975, I had signed up for a trade show, and I didn't expect to get in when the director of the show said, well, we have a place we can give you, which I was very surprising news. He said, by the way, what's your company called? And I tried to act very nonchalant and said, well, actually, we're just in formation now. We're choosing among several names. Let me give you a call tomorrow, and rushed home and talked with my wife. And we agreed that the Tumi had a lot of meaning for us, so it was a sentimental choice and it stuck for a long time.
Now, how do you go from the Peace Corps to starting a major business? What happens in between those two?
After graduating with a degree in literature, I realized that I wasn't going to be a professor, wasn't going to be the world's next greatest writer, so decided to really focus on something that would allow me to earn a living.
And why travel bags?
Everything is a little bit serendipitous in life, I think, a question of timing and many other things. When I came back, after spending that time in the Peace Corps, I worked for the Grand Union Company in retailing and then joined a company run by a friend of a friend, which was a small importing company doing really probably dozens of handcrafted products from half the countries, or at least it seemed like it was half the countries in South America, ranging from wall hangings to rugs to hand-carved gourds to leather goods, happened to be one of the product categories. And my friend did not want to focus on leather goods. So After some discussions with him, I decided to leave the company and to take leather goods as a product category that we could focus on and develop a business.
Where did you initially source your bags?
Well, this company was sourcing from Colombia, and we ended up going to Colombia and working with suppliers there who served us very well for many years.
What was the political situation like in Colombia, and did that affect at all the quality or the consistency of the bags you were getting?
Well, it didn't really. We were always a little apprehensive about our shipments getting through customs because even at that time in the late 70s and early 80s, Colombia was notorious for the drugs that were coming into the States. So we were always a little nervous and hoping that nobody had slipped anything into the containers. But we really didn't have any direct political effects.
How did you raise capital initially?
Well, we didn't have a lot of capital, Jessica. We started with an investment of $10,000, if I remember correctly. And my half of that consisted of some leather tennis bags that I had accumulated from the company that I had been working for previously. They weren't able to pay me some money they owed me. Times were a little bit difficult, so they paid me in tennis bags. And at least I was able to convert them into some capital for the new business.
And what state were you living in at the time?
We were living in New Jersey.
So you were importing these bags from Colombia, and who were you selling them to?
Our initial customers were byproducts of the wonderful 60s, the age of Aquarius. There were a lot of people running leather stores where they might be making sandals and belts in the back and possibly putting some bags together. But we had a product grouping that was a very rustic, natural leather, very rugged leather. So we fit in very well to this environment. But the specialty stores and the leather goods luggage area were the ones who really were responsible for helping to establish the brand. I think our first year of sales were $630,000.
Now, you had a shift in design from the 1970s to the 1980s. What was that shift in design?
It all started to, one of the key points, critical points in the company was the period, which I think was 82, 83, when we had this awful stagflation in the country. The interest rates for a company like ours were in the 20% area. There was a serious recession on, so our sales started to decline. And we really had to look in the mirror, look inwards, and say, what are we going to be when we grow up? We lost money for a couple of years. We had the bone-chilling experience, if you will, of having lunch with our bankers and coming back to the office and telling them that we had suffered a loss for the quarter. And the bankers all of a sudden looked very grave and very serious. And the meeting ended fairly quickly. And we had a call as soon as they got back to their office in Philadelphia suggesting they thought it would be a good idea if we came down to Philadelphia for a chat the following Monday. And when my partner and I arrived in Philadelphia and we went to the floor we'd been told to visit and found the office, we saw a sign over it saying Asset Recovery Department. And we realized that we were in a little bit of a difficult situation. We had to cut expenses and tighten our belts. And we happened to have a terrific homegrown designer by the name of Jeff Bertelsen. And he really deserves full credit for coming up with the designs that put us on the map. He isolated himself, worked in a little cubicle, probably smaller than 8 by 10, and drew and sketched and had some samples made and came up with these highly functional products which reflect the way people packed.
And what do those products look like for those who don't have the luxury of having a Tumi bag?
Well, the whole key to our core design concept was using U-shaped pockets. And the U-shaped pockets allowed people to pack easily, to open the pockets, the flap would come down, and they could put folded shirts or a toiletry kit or shoes or rolled-up sweaters or any one of a number of items in those pockets.
My husband has a Tumi bag, and he loves the fact that if you unzip the middle part, it opens up this vast space. It doesn't look apparent from looking at it. It looks like a compact bag, but really there's a lot of secret space or storage in there.
Well, before we developed this particular look, most of the luggage pieces on the market were semi-structured, and the category of products known as business cases really consisted of hard attachés. And they were very sturdy and very workmanlike, but not particularly user-friendly. We took this U-shape zipper concept that we employed in our garment bags, and thanks to Jeff's efforts, we really carry this look over into business cases. And one of the great features that we put into it, which Jeff added, was a expandable section. And for many of the pieces, that would increase the capacity by up to 50%.
Were they adopted immediately, or did it take some time for the public to get used to this new fashion?
It definitely took a few years, but it wasn't until about our third trade show that I realized we had really hit upon something, because many of the owners and the buyers from this highly influential specialty store network were visiting our stand at the show, and they were carrying Tumi bags. When it moved from advertising people and architects and other creative types and to the buyers and then to the financial industry, where many of the investment bankers that we did business with in later years were using Tumi products, then we realized that we had this walking advertisement that was out there every day.
So it seems that actually negative circumstances helped you, the fact that there was stagflation and the economy was in the doldrums, and the fact that bankers were on your back really caused you to be lean and creative about your designs. At one point, you bought out your partner because you had different views on the business. You wanted to hire talent and grow more aggressively, and he was more conservative when it came to hiring and growing the business. How did you go about that process?
I really didn't have any cash at all. I realized that finally that I would have to go to my father-in-law, George Beale, for a loan. And I didn't want to do that because he had been interested in the business and he was a very successful manufacturer's rep in the packaging industry and invested in a little packaging company and done well. But I was quite proud of being independent and finding my own way. And I think he was kind of bemused at his son-in-law peddling bags around the country. Well, having determined I was going to buy my partner out, I sought him out and told him what the story was, and he said he would be happy to take a look at it and try to help me out. And I can recall sitting down with him and pulling out a balance sheet, and he mused over it for a few minutes and scratched his head and said, gee, the way I look at it, looks to me like you're broke.
Oh.
And I said, well, technically, we've got a negative net worth at this time. We've had a couple of tough years, but I really believe we can turn this thing around and make something of it. And he wasn't quite as sure as I was, but being my father-in-law, he decided to invest with me. And we had a negotiation about the investment, and he wanted to buy all stock, and I wanted it all as a loan. And we finally compromised, and the money he put in was half stock and half loan. And I'm happy to say that he came out very well with his investment. And also, I'm very grateful and appreciative of the fact that his investment allowed me to buy my partner out and for us to embark on what proved to be a very long and fruitful journey.
Did that at all impact your relations with them personally?
Well, his being an investor in the business, I guess, gave us something to talk about whenever I visited. He was always interested in what we were doing and how we were doing it, and I would try to provide him with just enough information to make him comfortable but not get into too much detail. So it was always a little bit of a chess match when we were talking about how the business was doing.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi, a leading travel accessories company that was founded in 1975. What role did your family play in this whole process over the 25-plus years you're with the company? What about your wife?
She was an adult educator, worked in education for many years, and her career was as important to her as mine was to me. But behind the scenes, she was extremely supportive. When we were pinching pennies, we had salespeople and other visitors stay with us on a pretty regular basis. When times got difficult and the bank asked for personal guarantees, as she was right there signing alongside me. And we wouldn't have had any kind of success if she had not been supportive of the business.
How many children do you have?
We have two children.
And what was their interaction with the business?
Our son got involved with the business about 7 or 8 years, maybe 8 years ago. He didn't come in as the heir apparent. I'm proud to say that he didn't have any special privileges and has accomplished what he's done due to his own merits.
How about your daughter?
She spent about a year and a half, 2 years with the business and left the business after 9/11 because we were cutting back. And I had a very difficult conversation when I said, you know, we're going to be making some cutbacks, Tara. And she said, Daddy, you're telling me I'm going to be fired. And I said, well, not now, but we're going to be doing some layoffs at the end of the year. And because you're new to the company, I'm going to have to, you know, you're going to have to be included among the people who will be leaving because it wouldn't be fair to everybody else.
I want to switch to distribution. You do have over 50 retail stores around the world, yet you also depended on department stores like Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus in the early days. How did you think about selling the product or distributing the product?
One of our retailers in Santa Monica, California, was expanding into a mall there, and he said, look, I've got more space than I need. Why don't I open a Toomey store alongside mine? So that store was opened, I believe, in 1997. It succeeded really from day one, and we followed that with another probably 7, 8, 10 stores that we opened in partnership with specialty retailers where they operated the store, but we would participate with the design and with the fixturing of the store and show that retailing would be a successful model for the brand. And then following 2001, there was further consolidation of the industry. And it became apparent to us, one of our major customers at the time was a chain of over 140 stores. That was a byproduct of a merger and acquisition situation. So when the parent company, which was Wilson's Leather, decided to close the specialty stores, which were being operated under the names of Bentley's and El Portal, we lost close to 140 doors in one fell swoop. So that really forced us to take retailing as a serious avenue and to begin developing our own stores.
It seems interesting that you were dabbling in retail, but again, negative circumstances forced you into a business decision, which was to open up more retail stores after 2001.
Right. We probably would have begun opening our own stores, but we would have done it certainly at a much slower pace. That's correct.
How about celebrities using your bag?
Well, there were really dozens and dozens of celebrities who were using our bags, and we were always very discreet about using their names because that's something that's frowned upon. But people who were traveling frequently, entertainers, athletes, business people, of course, business executives, people from television, radio, singing, people were really on the road all the time. They became our best customers.
It's interesting that you are adamant about being discreet about that, whereas nowadays, you know, you see celebrities carrying around a certain bottled water or a certain handbag, and they are on, they're all over People magazine and in style. And so was there any of that?
Well, those are really paid placements that is where people are paid to give a soft endorsement to different products to be photographed using them. And we really, certainly in the early days, we really didn't participate in that. Now, in recent years, the company has given away some bags for events like the Grammys and the Oscars. But typically, the company has never looked for celebrities to endorse its products.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charlie Clifford, founder of Toomey, a leading travel accessories company that was founded in 1975. After September 11th, the travel business took a little dive.
Took a big dive.
So what did you do in response to that?
We had to begin cutting costs very aggressively. We deferred a couple of store openings. Most painfully, we had to let a number of people go.
How many employees did you have at the time?
We had over 500 at the time.
And how many did you have to let go?
25% probably.
Luckily, in 2002, you had a private equity firm, Oak Tree Capital, come in and buy 60% of the company for $35 million. Sometimes when private equity folks come in and venture capitalists come in, they try to not oust management, but replace the head guy with somebody whom they think is better. Did you ever have any of those leadership issues?
I realized at that time that moving to that kind of situation that it would be appropriate for me to make way, if you will, for somebody with more of a financial background. We did that in 2003 because it was appropriate for the business.
One of the other things you did was move your production from the Americas to Asia.
Following 9/11, we came to the painful conclusion that we would have to move our nylon production to Asia. We had been producing with a couple of brothers in Vidalia, Georgia, about 70 miles from Savannah, David and Alan Rice, who had been terrific partners for almost 20 years, approaching 20 years. And it was very, very difficult to have to go to them and tell them that we're going to be forced to move to Asia. And in this case, we did it because we needed to lower our costs and increase our margins. When we moved our leather production to Asia, it was more to improve the quality.
So the story ends well, because in 2004, Oak Tree and you sold to me to another private equity company for about $275 million. What are you doing in retirement? You've been retired for a few years now.
Well, in 2006, in the spring of 2006, I started to do some consulting with small and medium-sized companies, most of them related to the leather goods industry.
It seems like you can't stop working.
Well, when I started the business, my hair was brown, and I combed over the enough hair on the top of my head to make me feel that I was had hair. Now I've got a white beard and a bald pate, and so perhaps that's due to the wear and tear of the business. But it's been it was almost 30 years of a lot of joy, really.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. No, you're welcome, or thank you. I'm just kidding. My guest has been Charlie.
Deep breath. thank you, Jessica. It's been fun to talk with you.
My guest has been Charlie Clifford, founder of Tumi. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.